from the colorful studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another leafy hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, you bet your garden. Do you see your fall leaves as a chore instead of a gift? I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, I'll reveal how those leaves provide everything you need to have a superbly successful season. Plus, the family-run company that popularized Technicolor potatoes. And your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and harshly heroic habitations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up faster than your leaves working for you.
Thank you to the members of WDIY for making all the programming you hear possible. Becoming a WDIY member is the best way to support your listening and to ensure WDIY will be here for the next person in our community to discover. Make your membership gift today at 610-694-8100 extension 4 or wdiy.org. We couldn't be here without you.
From the studios of WDIY in Bethlehem, PA, welcome to yet another hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, you bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and this week we begin with an international in the news that's doubly good news all around. We're calling it Paris aims to become the city of green as well as the city of light. Or, as the original article was headlined, $55 million plan to add greenery at Notre Dame Revival. As recounted on October 19th by Associated Press reporter Thomas Adamson, the first piece of good news is that France's beloved Notre Dame Cathedral, devastated in a 2019 fire, is about to meet its five-year deadline to reopen in December. The second piece of good news is that the cathedral's return is not the only piece of restoration that will be on display, with Paris itself, quote, on the verge of a remarkable eco-revival, bringing nature back to the forefront of the City of Light. I continue to quote, beyond restoring the cathedral's ionic spire and medieval charm, the city announced Tuesday it would also revamp Notre Dame's surroundings into a serene green oasis. The plans for the new area around Notre Dame include 20,000 square feet of green space and 160 newly planted trees. Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo said the redesign will integrate nature and the Seine more fully into the area. She emphasized that the aim is to better highlight our beautiful cathedral and do it justice while respecting its history. The Seine's adjacent quays will also be revitalized, offering a new promenade along that historic river. The article explains that the project echoes a broader post-Olympics eco-facelift that's reshaping all of Paris, from its historical monuments to its bustling avenues. At the heart of Paris, the Place de la Concorde, home to the 3,300-year-old Luxor obelisk, will also undergo a significant overhaul beginning in 2026. Paris officials have enlisted the input of a dozen architectural experts to envision how to preserve its rich history while aligning the plaza with the city's modern green ambitions. We are told to expect more greenery and less traffic as the revamp balances historical impact with a fresh, eco-friendly design. The Champs-Élysées, sometimes called the most beautiful avenue in the world, is receiving a 30 million euro facelift, beginning with the renovation of its trees and gardens. With 150 proposals to, quote, re-enchant the Champs-Élysées over the coming years, the project aims to add even more green space and revive its historic charm. Leading from the Arc de Triomphe to the Bois de Boulogne, the Avenue La Grande is also getting the green treatment. Authorities plan to recreate a historic green promenade, transforming this major traffic artery into a lush, tree-lined boulevard that reconnects the avenue with a nearby forest, historically converted into a public park in the 19th century under Napoleon. Little bug, little bug, little bug, little bug, little bug. One little bug, little bug, little bug, little bug, little bug, little bug.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning public affairs programs weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, politics, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. Public Affairs on 88.1 FM, streaming at WDIY.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of the most eclectic NPR station in the universe, WDIY-FM. I'm Mike McGrath, and just a little bit, we will tell you everything you need to take those leaves laying all around and transform them into everything you need to have the best garden on the block next season. And it's coming up after your fabulous phone calls. 610-694-8100. At the prompt, choose extension number 3. But it'll tell you to do that anyway. The important thing is 610-694-8100. Steve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being had, Steve. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I am just ducky. Thanks.
That's
for,
awesome.
Thanks for asking. Yeah. Still trying to find a place to put a pond in here for ducky. So whereabouts are you?
So I am calling from Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
Know it well. Yeah, I furnished my entire house out of Amish barns out there.
Oh my gosh, hey, that's quality furniture right there.
Oh, it's fabulous.
Yeah, you can't beat it.
All right, so you're in Lancaster or near Lancaster?
In Lancaster.
Okay, very good. Okay, so what's up?
Well, so thanks to listening to your show for the past couple of years, I've gotten to the point where I can go crazy shopping for all kinds of tomato seeds online, grow the seeds, grow them into really healthy plants, harvest the tomatoes, turn them into fantastic pizza and tomato sauce.
Yep.
So to take them to the next level, I've found a specific tomato that I've started growing, third year in a row now, called, sorry if I butcher this, Pianello del Vesuvio.
Ah, okay, so it's an Italian tomato.
Yes, yeah, and I get it from, it's a seed company that's here in Pennsylvania, and the tomatoes are, I'd say, definitely bigger than a grape, but smaller than, like, a Roma, so somewhere in between.
So but it the, is, the, yeah, smaller than a paste tomato. Do you get enough meat in those to make good sauce?
Yeah, you have to. Well, so I grew 3 plants last year,
mm-hmm.
and definitely got enough for my family of 4 and some gifts to hand out to the rest of the Italian family. So, yeah, they worked out okay.
But they sound more like fresh eaten.
Yeah, and they could be, for sure. Although, Mike, I got to tell you, I subscribe to a pizza magazine. That's how nerdy I've gotten this whole thing. And they say that this is one of the best tomatoes you can grow for pizza sauce.
Oh, okay. Just have to be a little patient to get enough.
You do. You do. Well, speaking of patience, that brings me to my question. On the website where I get the seeds from, they say that you can get the tomatoes, string them up, and I guess hang them inside to concentrate the flavor and make it even better?
That is an interesting premise that I'm not familiar with.
Okay.
Concentrating the flavor would mean making sure that the leaves of the plant have the brightest possible sunlight, but the fruits are not exposed to the sun. That's why I think that anybody who prunes the suckers off their tomatoes, they're the sucker, because the greenery of those leaves was fuel for the plant, and you take off enough and you expose your fruits to sun scald, which looks exactly like it sounds. So I think we're wandering down a different path. And I thank you because it's the right time of year and we haven't spoken about this for a while.
Yeah.
What I try to advise people at this time of year, if they haven't had a really hard frost, where are you in your frost freeze?
We had, I'd say, two frost warnings, but we didn't get hit hard. Although I got to say, my tomato plants, they've bit it by now. I had to rip them out, and I'm planning for next year already.
Okay, good, because I would have stopped it. When the weather turns cool, you're really not getting any more photosynthesis or anything like that. The first thing you do is pull off all the flowers that have not yet become fruit, and then you pull off all the tiny fruits that really don't have a chance of making it to ripeness. Yeah. And this does concentrate all the plant's energies into the ones you leave behind. Now, part two of that is, you know, let's say you figure your season's going to be over in 5 to 7 nights. Go out to your garden and pick all of the full-size tomatoes that are green. Almost all tomatoes will continue to ripen up indoors if you protect them from sunlight and, you know, of course, have picked them at the right stage, but just let them sit out at room temperature. You never put tomatoes in a sunny windowsill. I want to meet the person who came up with that in a dark alley someday. You know, that's what you save them from. And of course, you know, never put a fresh tomato in the fridge. But the concept of bringing in full-size greenies is well known. There are even varieties that have been bred to not only be brought in green, but to take a long time to ripen up indoors. These are called, one name is Winter Keeper, and it's a slicing tomato, and you're supposed to get a big cardboard box, wrap each tomato in a piece of newspaper, and just one line, one level in the box, and, you know, check them every once in a while. And if something comes up and you're halfway through your project and you need some more ripe tomatoes, you just pick out some big ones and put them in a jar or a basket with an apple and an orange, and then cover that with like a kitchen towel. And that will give them the natural ethylene gas they need to finish the ripening stage. Now, your hanging tomatoes. I saw this email and it fascinated me. You know, obviously a lot of people hang their hot peppers at the end of the season. Mm-hmm. But one of the things you have to watch out for in keeping tomatoes, you know, some people who have this down, they're eating fresh tomatoes in January. Oof. So one thing you have to be careful about is to check them constantly and get any leaky ones out of there right away. If you've been growing tomatoes for a long time, you know what a bad tomato smells like. And it really can ruin the entire box. But now you got me thinking that if you bring these tomatoes in with a good amount of vine still attached, and you run something like a clothesline and use clothespins to hold them up there, not in direct sun, you would be able to watch the progression. And without the weight of the tomato bearing down on something, I think you would avoid a lot of rot.
I'd like to avoid both if I could, actually.
Yeah. The hanging would reduce the pressure and make it less likely. You know, I went to school to do this stuff. Make it less likely for the tomatoes to spoil. And, of course, you'd be able to keep an eye on them. And, again, same thing. Hang them up green. If you have tomatoes that are halfway at the breaker stage, just lay those out on a counter. They'll be ready in a few days. But if you get the handle of picking up them up at full ripeness while still green, those are tomatoes you can have ripen up sequentially over the next couple of months. And I can see where the hanging would give them an advantage by not having pressure on them.
Sure.
So how's that?
I love it, Mike. I knew you would have the answer to this. Thank you so much for taking the time to answer it for me.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. It's not something I've ever talked. You know, actually, that's not true. Years and years ago, I heard from people who uprooted their tomato plants towards the end of the season and then hung the entire plants from rafters in like a garage or a basement that didn't get too cold. And, you know, that would be the same thing. Maybe that's even what your people were talking about. But, yes, every full-size green tomato will become a red ripe one.
Well, I'll tell you what. If I get some good sauce from there, Mike, I'll be sure to send you a jar.
Oh, yeah. Sauce R Us.
Thank you for all your advice. I'll certainly give it a shot next year.
All right. Good luck to you, man.
Thanks, Mike. Take care.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and thank everybody who donated to our new presenting station, WDIY-FM, in Bethlehem during their recent pledge drive. And yes, that means I won't be begging you about it again for a while. But don't go cheering round the block just yet, because we'll be right back with the man whose family farm took potatoes from black and white to Technicolor. And more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of DIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. If you're not supposed to fill your compost pile with kitchen scraps, what are you supposed to do with them? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss the many ways you can reuse those scraps without shutting down your compost ambitions, plus your ambitious phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, everything you need to have a great garden and landscape is laying all around your property right now. And yes, we are talking fall leaves. We'll go over the important rules for how to harvest and use those leaves a little bit later on. But right now, it is time to welcome our very special guest, Jim Gerritsen, the founder, the grand poobah, the elder statesman of Wood Prairie Farm, which is internationally known for their work with potatoes and the quality of the seed potatoes they offer. And one thing, this is going to blow your mind. I mean, if you think there's like three or four different kind of potatoes out there, you should just sit back and relax. Jim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I am just ducky today. How are you, sir?
Just great.
And where is Jim great?
We have a farm in northern Maine in the town of Bridgewater, a potato farming town, and we're 6 miles from the Canadian border.
Oh, wow. Now, one thing that I've noticed, especially in talking to you and prep for this a little bit, is there is a heavy concentration of intrepid farmers in your region. You and I discussed Elliot Coleman and his wife Barbara Damarash, who run a four-season farm in your unforgiving climate. And going way back to the beginning, Johnny Selected Seeds on the rocky coast of Maine. Right? What is it about this area?
Well, I think Maine has always had an attraction for many people. It's a great state. The people are wonderful. It's a beautiful state. All the states in the nation, it's the most forested state, so it's very pretty. The rocky coast, but even inland, like where we are, there's a lot of trees and solitude, and you can basically do what you want to do without getting hassled by people. So I think people in Maine enjoy that.
When I was in Alaska, that's what every single person said. Why am I here? I'll tell you why. Nobody bugs us.
That's right.
Now, let's go back. I've known about Wood Prairie Farm for what seems like ages. How many ages is it? When did you start your business?
The farm started up in the mid-1970s, so we're coming up to our 50th anniversary.
Congratulations. And I want to talk very much. One of the things I was especially interested in is your crop rotation, because I have often thought, especially about you guys, how can you be a, quote, potato-only farm? That would not work. You can't run the same crop through the same fields year after year.
Well, I can explain it this way. Common to every organic farmer is the foundational part of their production system is a crop rotation. And what that means is you never grow the same crop in the same field for 2 years in a row. So in our case, we've got a 4-year crop rotation. So we've basically divided up all of our fields into four groups. Each group is about 10 or 12 acres, and it allows us, with our rotation, to plant 10 or 12 acres of potatoes every year, and then the remaining 30 to 36 acres are in soil improving, in our case, sod. As soon as we harvest potatoes, we immediately plant back to winter rye, undersown with Timothy grass and three types of clover. So for the 3 of the 4 years in our rotation, our fields are in sod, helping build up the organic matter, making a better quality soil to grow high quality seed potatoes. And then 1 out of the 4 years in that given field, we're growing potatoes.
Right, but you always have some place to grow, and the other three are being nourished. That's amazing. That takes up a lot of space, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, but that's really the old way of doing it. And I think, you know, potatoes is a relatively hungry crop. It's hard on the soil, and we think a four-year rotation is really good. The common rotation up here among the other potato farmers is either a two-year or a three-year rotation, and we think the four-year really does us well, and I think that's one of the secrets as to why our seed potatoes do so well, why they're so productive, why they give a nice crop when they're planted.
Yeah, and I will tell you, just for no good reason, I had my best potato crop in decades this season. Everything produced really well and nice quality. I've been troubled by hollow heart, as have my potatoes, some years, but nothing this year. Everything is just beautiful.
That's great. That's great. With hollow heart, it's a condition that tends to be variety specific. There are some varieties that tend to get it, and what hollow heart is a cavity in the center of the tuber, and it tends to occur by varieties that grow so fast that the inside can't keep up with the outside. So one way to cut down on hollow heart is to plant closer together so that you're crowding them so they won't grow quite as fast. And then also there's sometimes a boron deficiency associated with hollow heart. So if you can make sure that you've got adequate boron from a soil test, that might be another solution.
You know, I have to admit, I've never had a soil test. I just make compost, judge it by the way it looks and smells and feels, and use it all over the place. And my guess is there's enough different stuff in there that if the plant needs it, it'll find it.
Yeah, you know, that's a pretty common sense way to go. But when you do run into problems, then you start to study, well, what's the problem and what could be the solution? So it could be something as simple as like a boron deficiency. Calcium is not another nutrient that's important for good quality potatoes. But, you know, if you're not having problems, then I think that approach works very well. If you do run into problems, then it pays to try to understand what's going on so that you can come up with a solution. And usually, as you and I both know, usually there is a solution in organic gardening, in organic farming, but it means we have to do our homework. There typically isn't going to be some kind of a chemical answer, but no. Very often can be a short-term answer, but you've got to understand what's going on to come up with a solution.
Yeah, chemical fertilizers are going to cause nutritional problems, not correct them.
Now, right, you're working at cross purposes, right?
Yeah. Now, you produce an amazing number of varieties. You know, when I was starting out, you had your white potatoes, your russets. You had Yukon Gold, those real buttery, wonderful yellow potatoes. And, of course, you had the classic red skin potato. But you have Frankensteined these things together. You have gold flesh with red skins on the outside. You've got every combination that people could imagine, and they couldn't imagine most of them. But you take any of the colors, any of the flavors, your farm has produced something that just blows people away. It changes their whole concept of what a potato is.
Well, I think one of the sad realities of modern living is that agriculture has kind of been dumbed down. So the potatoes that you typically could find, say, 40 years ago in the grocery store, they were varieties that produced well and that farmers liked because of the yield. And since farmers were paid based on the, you know, tonnage they could produce, they would opt for varieties that were, you know, kind of hardware varieties that didn't have any great taste qualities. And I think for that reason, potatoes ended up getting a bad reputation that they were bland and nothing special to them, when in fact, there's a great diversity to potatoes, not only the colors, but also the texture, you know, the dry, flaky potatoes that we typically would cook as a baked potato, the lower solids, waxy potatoes that would hold its shape. So if you make a soup or a stew, you're going to have solid potato chunks in that. Anyway, there's a great variation. And we started out as market farmers ourselves, and we saw that there was a big consumer interest in the different types of potatoes. So when we got into growing seed, it was only natural. We wanted to grow the different varieties that people showed interest in. And then when we specialized in selling seed, the market farmers all across the United States, that was the demand we were trying to supply.
You just mentioned something I want to go back to. Choosing a potato variety based on what you're going to do with it. Can you go over those basics again of this type of potato is good for this type of use?
Yes. Well, my wife, Megan, put together what we call a potato texture chart, and we published that in our annual catalog, and now it's up on our website for 20 or 30 years now. But it's a little bit complicated, but you've got two different types of starch. You've got amylose starch, and then you've got branched starch called amylopectin. And the easy way for me to remember is that amylopectin is like pectin that you would add to strawberry jam so that it would solidify. And it's a hint that a potato that's high in amylopectin is going to be more solid and hold together because of that branched starch. And if you've got a potato that is high in amylose, that is unbranched and it's going to be not adhere together. So if you had a potato like the German variety that we grow, Corolla, that is high in amylose, and when you put it into a soup, it would dissolve down and thicken up the soup. By the same token, if you were to take a lower specific gravity potato that was high in amylose, that would keep its shape, say in a soup or a stew. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got that division between potatoes that are high in amylopectin starch and amylose. And then as you proceed along the continuum, you'd come up to potatoes that have a higher specific gravity, and specific gravity is the density of something compared to water. So something like the classic russet baker would be high in amylose starch, and it would be high in solid. So that would make for a nice, fluffy baked potato. The Yukon Gold is in that same group as the russet Burbank. You know, that's why people like it either as a baked potato or as a mashed potato. So there's basically, we've identified six different groups of potatoes, half of them in the amylose side of the ledger and half in the amylopectin side. And then they go from a low solids potato, low specific gravity, to a high solids potato, high specific gravity. And the different groupings allow you to get a pretty good handle on how these potatoes are going to do well in the kitchen. The higher solids potatoes are going to be lighter and fluffier. The lower solids potatoes, like the typical red potatoes, most of the purple potatoes, those tend to be low solids and what farmers call low gravity potatoes, which is simply an abbreviation for low specific gravity.
In addition to choosing via those virtues, there's also the consideration of timing, right? There's early, mid, late potatoes. How exactly does that work? I don't understand that. I just put them in the ground, and when the plant dies, I harvest them.
Yeah, you can be as informal as really fits your need and your system. But, you know, potatoes can range anywhere from 65 or 70 days after planting to where you have tubers ready to harvest to, on the other end of the spectrum, 130, 140 days. And Russ at Burbank, for example, probably the number one potato grown in the world. It's certainly the number one variety. It's the number one type grown in the United States. But now, whereas Russ at Burbank was dominant 30 years ago, I think it was selected by Luther Burbank in 1874. So for over 100 years, it was the predominant variety in the United States. And now there are probably 20 russet varieties that have come around mostly in the last 30 years that are rivaling that, that may have some great keeping ability, or it fries at a higher, brighter color, so it's more advantageous for being made into French fries, sometimes made into chips. Anyway, there's a great variety. It simply is, how long does it take them to grow? And to my way of looking at it, if you're comparing an 80-day variety to a 120-day variety, the 80 days in some ways can be more reliable because you have less of a window for something to go wrong.
I hear that. Now, you offer a wide variety of seed potatoes. And yeah, I love the artwork on the packages and everything like that. How many different varieties do you generally have in stock?
This year we're offering, I think, 22, and we've got three more that we're propagating up and we'll be releasing in the next few years. For us, when we get a new variety in, we get potato plantlets through the tissue culture process. We grow them and produce mini tubers. Then the mini tubers get planted the next year in a aphid excluding screened long tunnel. And we harvest from the soil what are called FY1 field year one tubers. And we multiply them up for one or two more years before we have them for sale. So every year we've got, you know, probably 70 seed lots from 20 to 25 different varieties, different generations. It's kind of like a row, row, row your boat deal that we're always multiplying up. And then once they get to a certain volume, then we can afford to sell them.
All right, Jim, I have to stop you right there because it's time for us to take a little break. But we'll be back to discuss more potato talk right after this.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100 or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and yes, we are in the stretch, cats and kittens. Just a little bit, we will tell you everything you need to take those leaves laying all around to have the best garden on the block. But before that, it's time to get back to our interview with Jim Gerritsen of Wood Prairie Farm, the master of potato growing. One of the things that made me decide to invite you on was your announcement of this new potato that you're kind of crazy wild about.
Well, this story goes back originally back to Russia, and there was a plant breeder by the name of Vavilov, who was a spectacular plant breeder, only he got on the wrong side of Stalin, and he was thrown in prison and ended up dying in prison in 1943. But one of the things that he made significant progress on was the breeding of superior potatoes. And then there was a family of potato breeders in Hungary by the name of Sharvari, and they began breeding something like 40 years ago, taking some of the lines from the collection of Avaloff. And their goal was to be able to produce potatoes that had high yield and were naturally resistant to things that would plague potatoes, insect disease, things like that. They developed a line of potatoes. There are now, I think, six, maybe seven varieties that have been released, and it's called the Sharpo varieties. And the variety that we introduced a few years ago was the first one, Sharpo Mira, which was a late high-yielding variety, a nice long potato, a rosy pink skin, off-white flesh that was very light and fluffy and great for baking, great for mashing. And this new variety that we finally propagated up enough to where we have enough to sell this year is called Sharpo Una, U-N-A. And that is a name because it's the earliest variety. The Sharpo Mira is about a 140-day variety, and it really yields high, but you can harvest it whenever you want, but it will keep growing if you have enough growing days, which we don't in northern Maine. But the Sharpo Una is a very high-yielding, early red. It's got a brighter red skin, white flesh. The yields, we've grown it now for 3 years in propagating it up, and the yields every year has astounded us. So I think that it's going to be a great addition. Getting back to the texture idea, the gravity on this new Sharpo Una, it's a low-gravity potato, a low solids potato, so it's going to be especially good for things like au gratin or salads or stews or soups in that it will hold its shape. But it's one that we're really excited about because of the high, it's got good taste and then it's got high yield potential in our experience. And again, this is because this breeding was done traditional breeding, crossing with they actually, part of the collection that Vavilov had went back to wild potato relatives that they obtained from Peru and Mexico and crossed that into varieties that were known for good eating to be able to get a blend of good-tasting varieties that perform well in the kitchen and that also had exceptional disease and insect tolerance in the field.
These new varieties sound like winners, but I look at your catalog, I look at Rose Gold, and all these wonderful color and flavor combinations. I'll close with something I tell everybody. If you want to taste a true potato, you have to grow potatoes. Because when you harvest your first batch out of the ground, I have a hose out there, and I rinse them off, and I pick a nice one and bite right into it like it was an ear of sweet corn. And you can only experience that flavor if you grow it, because you know potatoes are a storage crop, so I don't know what other word to use. Juicy. I could sit out there and eat them all day.
Well, what you just revealed is something that only gardeners know about. But in the same way that if the only tomato you ever ate was one from the grocery store, you wouldn't understand why do people get so excited about eating fresh tomatoes. And I've often asserted that a fresh potato, like you describe, is every bit as remarkable as that fresh tomato that you pick off the vine in your garden. It's really something to behold. And only from gardening do you experience that.
Yeah, I mean, other people talk about their first tomato, and I wait for my first potato for that ritual. Well, Jim, I mean, I could keep you on for hours, but I won't. We've been talking to Jim Gerritsen, I should say, and family, because that's what makes up the farm. The name of the farm and the company is Wood Prairie. They have a wonderful newsletter called The Seed Piece.
It's actually there. We have the URL woodprairie.organic, and we have the URL woodprairie.com.
Yeah, because you got to look at these colors, if nothing else. We didn't even talk about the beautiful flowers. My producer will shoot me if I go into another topic. So, Jim, it's great talking to you. Best of luck. I'm thrilled your family is going to continue your legacy. And God bless potatoes, man.
Thank you, Mike. You take care.
You too. Bye-bye. All right, as promised, it is time for the question of the week, which we are calling the art and etiquette of fall leaf collection. Yes, it's time for our yearly special report on how to harvest, store, and utilize those wonderful fall leaves, nature's annual gift to gardeners. I've been saying it for some 35 years now, and it was true the first time and remains true today. Correctly capturing this manna and mulch from heaven provides everything your garden will need to prosper without chemicals of any kind. Now, we got a lot of cover, so let's do this bullet point style. One, no bending. Yes, they are down there on the ground, but that doesn't mean that you have to stoop to their level to harvest them. If you're bending over at any point in this process, you're doing it wrong. Or as we love to say here, bending is for chumps. Leaves on lawns. Perhaps the easiest and most straightforward use of your leaves. Employ a mulching mower to mow the leaves right back into the lawn. Mulching mowers have super sharp blades that pulverize the leaves into a fine powder. Allowing that powder and the tips of the grass you'll also be going over to drop back down feeds the lawn, eliminates thatch by creating a layer of biological material that prevents thatch from ever forming, and of course, gets rid of those visible leaves. Mulching mowers also protect your lawn the rest of the year by ensuring a clean cut and by feeding the lawn a little bit every time you mow. If you have a chemical-free lawn, use the bagging attachment on your mower to collect those crazy mixed-up pulverized leaves and grass clippings, and empty the contents of the bag into a compost pile or bin. That perfect combination of dry brown carbon in the leaves and wet green nitrogen in the clippings creates a mix that heats up quickly and produces the highest possible quality compost. Don't add anything. It's already perfect. But if you have a chemically treated lawn, boo on you, any clippings from that lawn must stay on the lawn. The persistent chemical herbicides used on treated lawns are not destroyed in the composting process, and any compost made from such clippings will weaken and or kill any non-turf plants it's used on. A bagging mower is also a great way to collect leaves that aren't on a lawn. Blow or rake the leaves onto a flat surface like a driveway and mow them into the bag. If the mower is a mulcher, they should be shredded small enough to be put directly into a compost pile or placed in a large lidded trash can all by themselves for use as a fabulous, nourishing, non-toxic mulch next season. Those awful dyed wood mulches nourish nothing and are about as far from non-toxic as you can get. Oh, and they breed nuisance molds that can stain your house, make you sick, and or give birth to a stinkhorn fungus but my main leaf capture machine is the Blower Vac, a leaf blower that comes with a differently shaped funnel and a collection bag, allowing you to shred your leaves as you harvest them. And today's models are much quieter because they're electric powered, either by a rechargeable battery or a cord. All you do is take off the blower attachment, replace it with the sucker, and the machine instantly reverses direction. Just suck up the leaves and empty the bag into your compost pile or bin. Note, these leaf shredders come in a variety of sucking strengths, indicated by the, quote, mulching ratio listed on the package, like 8 to 1 or 12 to 1, etc. The higher the number on the box, the smaller particle size you'll achieve, and the best compost is made with leaves shredded their smallest. Now, let's say the ratio of a machine you're considering is 8 to 1. That means you can rake up 8 bags worth of whole leaves, empty them out, suck them up, and the machine will take those 8 bags of whole leaves down to 1 single bag after shredding. Obviously, leaves shredded in a 12 to 1 machine will have even smaller individual particles, which equals better quality compost that will be available sooner in the spring. So go big here, you'll never regret it. Now comes the compost cooking, a compost bin or pile filled only with grass clippings and shredded leaf mixtures from a non-treated lawn will cook at the highest possible rate. Add nothing. A pile or bin filled with well-shredded leaves alone will need a little help. And the easiest and cheapest way to provide that help is with spent coffee grounds. They're the perfect grass clipping replacement and available to you for free at any local coffee shop. My guesstimate is to add a 5-gallon bucket's worth of spent grounds per bin or pile. And because they wasn't collected together, be sure to mix the grounds in well with the shredded leaves as you fill that container. Now, if you want to stray outside of those pure carbon nitrogen mixtures, you can mix in some kitchen scraps as you go. Avoid citrus entirely and go easy on alliums like onions. Like it or not, the compost will be inferior and slow to cook if you incorporate more than 10% of your kitchen waste. Sorry. So, what should you do with all the stuff you wanted to have a compost pile for in the first place? We'll dispose of that topic next week. Those sure were a lot of neat ways to prepare to use your fall leaves in the season ahead, now wouldn't they? Luckily, you can read all of that important information over at your leisure or your leisure at the Gardens Alive section of the Gurney's website. Just visit the Gurney's site and click on Garden Resources or type GURNEYS plus You Bet Your Garden into your favorite search engine. Yikes, my producer is threatening to set loose my leaves if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore, at our new email site, youbetyourgarden1 ubetyourgarden@gmail.com. Having trouble finding You Bet Your Garden after our recent station switch? Be troubled no more. You'll find our new phone number, our new email, a link to the Gardens Alive archive of previous answers, and new links to our various podcast sites, all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he hid behind the chainsaws with those kids in that Halloween car insurance commercial. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprote. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY. Our guardian angel is the lovely Jonas Bowen. Our invaluable assistant is the legendary, awesome Ninja Sean. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll be collecting and shredding my own leaves for use next season. Until I remind you to do the same thing again next week.